This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the journalist Howard Blum, telling us a true tale of the Klondike Gold Rush and the last American frontier. Your new book, Howard, comes with the title The Floor of Heaven, a phrase you borrow from Shakespeare and a place that you locate in Canada's Yukon Territory. You shape the narrative around the lives of three men braving the hazards of new fortune. But before you tell us who they are, set the scene in the summer of 1897 with the steamer Portland arriving in Seattle with 2 tons of solid gold.
In 1897, when the steamer arrived in Seattle, America was on the skids. It was very much like America is today. The panic of 1893 had turned out into a full-grown depression. Banks were closing. There were fistfights on the New York Stock Exchange. Farms were being foreclosed. And people felt they had nothing, and they didn't know where to turn. They had no faith in the government to solve their problems. And then suddenly, they're offered this vision that gold has been discovered in the Yukon, and they can stick a pan into a Yukon stream, and presto, they'll have the answer to all their prayers. So people who had nothing to lose were willing to gamble everything. They head off to the Yukon. They have no idea where the Yukon is. They have no idea what's in store for them. They leave in August from all around the world. From Seattle, people were leaving at the rate of 2,500 a day. The first day, the headline appeared in New York about 2 tons of gold coming from the Yukon. 7,000 tickets were sold for Seattle and then on to the Yukon. They board ships that are creaking vessels. They're packed like sardines. One person who wrote about it at the time compared it to the black hole of Calcutta, but in an Arctic setting. They get on these boats, and then they think the boats are going to let them off right by the gold fields. The boats leave them a mile offshore. They have to throw all their belongings that have been carefully packed into the water. The belongings get ruined. Horses and mules are being thrown into the water and whining and drowning. And then people by the thousands go on the beaches. John Muir, the naturalist, looked at the scene, and he says, like an ant colony, but the ants have been beaten by sticks, and people are running around wild. And then once they get there, they still have to get into the Yukon, which is a treacherous journey in the winter. It's impossible. They have to wait for spring to come so they can make this journey. And they go to this little town of Skagway. Skagway means, it's an Indian name, mean the town of the north wind. And it's an idyllic setting. There's a couple of beautiful crystal clear lakes. There's the Alaskan coast, there's evergreen forests, and in the background there's snow-capped mountains, a wonderful place. And in 1897, there's just one man living there.
This is the Alaskan archipelago in the south. I mean, this is not the far north where the Skagway is.
Right. This is the southeast Alaskan coast, and it's really beautiful, idyllic place. But when there's one man who claimed the town called wanted all for himself, he'd been there for 10 years, suddenly all the pioneers, the prospectors are coming in. They take over all the land, and the town becomes, according to the Northwest Mounted Police, the most dangerous town in the world. People are being shot, their saloons, their con men, and still people have to get to the actual gold fields themselves. And this involves either going over the Chilcot Pass or the White Pass. And as one prospector said, one's hell and the other's worse. It's a very dangerous journey. And then once they get there, they have to build their own boats to go down the Yukon Lakes and the Lake Lindeman to finally get to the gold fields. And then they have to expect to find it. It was a really much a fiasco.
The Chilcot Pass, describe it. It's 4 miles straight up, and it's still 500 miles to the gold field.
The Chilcot Pass is like climbing the side of a building. The trails pass are very narrow, and yet men would line up all day. There's a picture in my book of this long, long line of people just going up the pass. And it's a 4-day journey, perhaps. And at the same time, you have to, the Canadian Mounted Police, who are at the top of the pass before you can enter Canadian territory, are stopping people. You must have 500 pounds of provisions. Now, carrying 500 pounds of provisions mean you had to make at least 2 or 3 trips. And this, too, was a tremendous burden. The people who did it made great sacrifices. They refused to surrender to the elements, to endurance. And yet, once they got there, they still had to go for days down boats and then look for gold fields. And very few of the second wave after the first ship came in actually found gold.
How far do they go from the lakes and then up the Yukon River? And they're getting to a place called Dawson City. Describe Dawson City.
Dawson City was just a swamp before the gold rush. There was one bar there, and the same 8 or 9 prospectors would be there pretty much all year around. Once gold was found in the Yukon right on Bonanza Creek, which is only about 10 miles from Dawson City, it became the richest town on earth. The problem was there was no money. All they had was gold dust. This was the real gold standard. You had to pay for everything in gold because there was nothing else they could use until they got their gold out of the Yukon, down to Alaska, and into Seattle to cash it in. They were stuck with gold. So you'd buy an egg for a big nugget of gold. Poker was played for king ransoms in gold nuggets. To build a house or a little shack just to get the nails, it was the equivalent of $800 for just a few nails. It was the richest town in the world.
Richer than London or Paris. But it was many tents, and they had the saloons, and the brothels were in the tents.
Yes, it was a totally wide open hoorah town and dangerous. People got used to people being murdered in the so-called streets just in between the tents that they paid no attention. The bodies would stay there sometimes for days until someone said, well, let's drag them out into the woods. Everyone was consumed with this belief that they could change their lives around by finding gold.
Go back now to who discovered the gold strike in 1896. That's a man named George Carmack, who is one of the three principal figures in your book. So explain Carmack and how he was there and who he was living with and his relation to the Indians.
George Carmack was a fascinating and flawed man. He grew up in California. His father was one of the prospectors during the 49 gold rush in California, and his father never found anything. And his father died very young when George was just 8, but he passed down this vision to George that someday you've got to strike it rich. And George was determined to do so, to get money for his expedition to Alaska, and he was sure that he would find gold there. He joined the Marines, then he went AWOL from the Marines, and he went off into the wilderness, going over the Chilcot Pass. He spent 8 years roaming around Alaska, and he was overwhelmed with loneliness, with the elements, and the only way he found he could survive was to be taken in by the Indians. And he joined the Taglish Indian tribe. He worked with 2 Indians as a packer. They introduced him to their sister, and he, in a sense, married her. They had a child. And he was really at a dead end, and he basically had a dream one night. And the dream said that he would find a gold-coated salmon in a stream. And he thought, well, this made pretty good salmon fishing. So he went up the stream, and there were no fish. And finally, he deciphered the dream a little more, and he went off with the Indians, and he went deeper into the mountains, and he found this Bonanza Creek, and he became rich. And what did he do? The first thing when he became rich, he got rid of his Indian wife, just like today, I guess, on Wall Street, traded her in for a trophy wife, who was a dancehall girl from Australia, and he made quite a fortune, then invested in real estate in Seattle. But at the same time, he turned his back on his whole past. He reinvented himself as soon as he made his money.
But he had been in Alaska in the 1880s, because the big strike is 1896. But as early as 1880, it was known that there was gold somewhere in Alaska.
Yes. Around Juneau, there were mines with hard rock mines where you had to dig really deep to find this, but you couldn't stick your pan into the streams. That was a great vision that you could do as people did in California, and that gold would be found in a Yukon stream. And he was the one who went there and found this stream that he'd always dreamed about, a tributary of the Yukon, and he stuck his pan in, and it was as if he were picking up gold from the floor of heaven, and he became rich.
But he had also spent some time in the Treadwell Mine near Juneau.
Yes, the Treadwell Mine near Juneau, he was basically there as a laborer. The Treadwell Mine was a more or less a mill that took some hard rock mining of gold deposits, and the Treadwell Mine was on an island outside Juneau. What was fascinating about that is it was the only place west of Chicago where there was electricity, really, at that time in the late 1880s. Why was there electricity? Well, same as today, so people could work around the clock, and people would go up to the Treadwell Mine and suddenly see it lit up, this whole island lit up at night, and they went to the ends of the earth and saw the future of America there.
So before Carmack moves north to discover his fortune, he's in the Treadwell Mine, and there he meets one of your second principal characters, and who is he?
Charlie Siringo. Charlie Siringo had grown up in Texas, became a cowboy. He fought the Indians. He led cattle drives up the Chisholm Trail. But as the West was changing, Carmack, and this my book really is a story about the end of the West, he decided he had to look for something else. Fitzgerald said there are no second acts in American life. Well, Siringo was convinced he could find one, and he had just gotten married, and he had gone to Chicago. He'd gone there with this vision in his mind that he would maybe become a writer, and he would write up all his cowboy stories, his quick draw stories, and he had ridden against Billy the Kid, hunted for him, but he decided the writing wasn't going too well. It's rough business to be a freelance writer, and he decided to join the Pinkerton Detectives. Now, the head of the Pinkertons decided, well, here I have a guy who was a cowboy. Why not make him the cowboy detective? And he ships Charlie Siringo to the Denver office. And for the next 22 years, Charlie is this cowboy detective. And he's really the core hero of my book. And as the cowboy detective, using all his cowboy skills of courage and tenacity and quick draw talents and dog-headedness, he decides to go off to solve this case of who stole gold from the Treadwell mine. And in the course of that adventure, which takes him well over a year and takes him into Alaska and then into the Yukon, he meets up with George Carmack.
Do they become friends?
They become wary friends. What happens is Siringo is very inventive, and he's working undercover in the Treadwell mine, and he's working as an oiler. And they have this crushing room where they're literally 550 devices that crush the stone, and he gets his arm or the sleeve of his coat caught in one of these crushers, and it looks as if his hand is going to be smashed to smithereens, just as if it were a rock. And at the last moment, this man saves him, and he looks like an Indian. It turns out to be George Carmack. Carmack is very suspicious of Siringo. He doesn't think he's really an oiler. But at the same time, Carmack is an AWOL Marine, and he thinks, well, this is the U.S. government. They sent someone to look for him, want to bring him back to the States to stand trial, throw him in the brig.
So these are two great characters of the American West, the dreaming prospector, the cowboy detective. And who's your third major character? Who is another great character of the American West?
My third character is Soapy Smith, who's the archetypal villain in many ways. Soapy Smith starts off in Denver. He has this vision of being sort of a con man. What he does is he gathers people around and he auctions off soap where he puts money inside. Of course, only what the boys in his gang get the soap with the money. And that's how he gets the nickname Soapy. His real name is Jeff Smith. This works for a bit in Denver, and then he goes off to Creed, another gold, silver town, really, in the Denver Mountains. But finally, he's run out of place, out of town after town, and he's at really his wit's end. And then gold is discovered in the Yukon, and he says, this is where I'll make my last stand. This is going to be the last frontier, and I'm going to be there. So he gathers up his gang, and he goes up to Skagway. And from Skagway, he starts his criminal empire. He has a variety of scams. He's running the brothels. He's running the bars. He's also selling phony real estate. He's selling phony mines. When people come to town and want to go over the pass, he's telling them their supplies will never get past the Canadians on the other side, so you have to buy my supplies. And then he resells the supplies that he's confiscated from these other people. But just to get an idea of his scams, one of my favorite is 10,000 people are rolling into Skagway off the boats, and they want to communicate with their people back home that they've arrived safely. So you go to this telegraph office that Soapy is running, and for $5 you can send a message back home, and for $5 you'll get a reply back the next day. And he collects these from tens of thousands of people. The problem is there's no telegraph line in Skagway at all for the next 10 years.
So his men are writing the answers.
His men are writing the answers, yes. Everything is always good at home when you pay your $5 to Soapy.
But he's also a killer and a gangster. And talk a little about that, because he comes to a violent end.
He does come to a violent end, as his men are literally assaulting the prospectors. So they come back with their pokes. They're stealing it. And a vigilante committee is growing in Skagway, and they say, this state of nature can't exist. We've got to bring law and order to our little town. And their main focus of this animosity is Soapy Smith. And Soapy is not going to go down without a fight. Along the way, which leads to his demise, he tries to steal George Carmack's gold, and he's held off by Charlie Siringo and a group of Indians who work with Carmack. And after that, people feel, well, Soapy can be taken. And they have a rally on one of the wharfs. The wharf is still there if you go to Skagway, and you can see it. About 800 people are there saying, we've got to get rid of Soapy. And Soapy, who's been drinking all day, says, they're not going to push me off. This is my last stand. So he grabs a rifle and a revolver, and he goes down to confront them, to tell them to disperse. But he's stopped along the way, and he gets into a fight, and he draws on another man, shoots the other man, but the other man gets off a shot, and Soapy dies, is killed on that wharf in Skagway. And he's buried in the woods behind town in a small cemetery. When his widow comes up, she's been down in St. Louis where she's been waiting for him to really make it rich, comes to see him. She finds out that all his money is allegedly gone. All his friends took it, and she's left with nothing. She has to borrow money to get her passage back to the States. But what makes Soapy such an interesting character are the contradictions. He's a man who can be extremely violent one moment and then kind in the next. He's philanthropic and also a thief. He's a great American villain because he carries within him many of the contradictions that make American heroes so fascinating.
The killer with a heart of gold.
Sometimes, unless he wants to take your gold.
That's the end of Soapy. First of all, how long does the gold rush last? It begins 1896, and when's it over? And then what happens to Siringo and Carmack?
The gold rush begins in 1896, and by the time the word gets to America, as we began with the boat coming in 1897, really all the big gold claims have been taken. There are at least a dozen people who are going to become millionaires out of it, but they have all the good sites. By the time the next wave of 10, 20, 40,000 people come there, the gold is all gone. By 1898 or 9, people have given up, basically. It was a very quick gold rush, and a gold rush, though, that the stampede that made real millionaires, but they were the first wave, like any investors, like people buying gold today. Gold is now going sky high, but do you want to go in and buy it today? I'm not so sure.
What happens to Carmack?
Carmack, as I said before, he has this Indian squaw, and he claims he never married her, and he gets in the hands of a Seattle divorce lawyer who makes his case for him. She's totally cut off. He goes off with this woman who was running a laundry and a brothel in Skagway, and he marries her. They move back to Seattle. They invest in real estate. But at the same time, Carmack, even as he gets into his 60s, still wants to find gold again. That was a high point of his life. That defined him. That was his greatest accomplishment. And he spends his remaining 20 years after the gold rush looking for mines in the States and never really finding one. And then he dies while working on a mine south of Los Angeles.
And Siringo is, the end of his life is a segue into the Hollywood Western and the myth of the Western frontier.
Yes. Siringo finally does sit down and writes his books. He wrote four biographies about his adventures as a cowboy and as the cowboy detective, and they're wonderful. He has a great wit. It's sort of a Will Rogers approach to the West. And one of the books is read by William S. Hart. The movies have just come to Los Angeles, Hollywood, and Hart is now this great cowboy star, and he wants a real hero, a real cowboy there. So Siringo, in his 70s, moves out there and becomes an advisor and is an extra in one of the movies. And there's a picture of him in my book advising William S. Hart. And in one scene, there he is on a horse riding off in the background. He's still 74, still tall in the saddle. His mustache is white. But he really has become the last American hero.
And on that note, thank you, Howard Blum, for speaking with us today about the Yukon Gold Rush and the last American frontier. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2011.